Max Jacobson was giving out these vitamin elixir shots, right? These special vitamin shots. They were really 30 milligrams to 40 milligrams of methamphetamine, which made you feel great until you hit the wall and needed another shot, and then you fell into this unbelievable depression. So that's what Max Jacobson did.
Ladies and gentlemen!
He convinced himself at a certain point that because the drug was, I mean, he actually said, do I want to be called Dr. Feel Bad? No, I want to be called Dr. Feel Good. That's what I make people. I make them feel good. So he saw himself delusional on this mission to make people feel good. That's how serious this was in 1962, all brought to that point by a drugged-out Kennedy who couldn't stand up to Khrushchev, who believed that Kennedy could be rolled over like some bum in the street.
Right.
That's Jacobson. So Gene Connor's a patient, Judy Exner Campbell's a patient, Peter Lawford's a patient, Sammy Davis Jr.'s a patient, Dean Martin's a patient, Frank Sinatra's a patient.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with the penultimate edition of BOA Audio Season 7. And it has been far too long since you've heard from me. I feel like I've been saying this at the beginning of the last several programs, so stay tuned to the end of the show for the big reveal of the BOA Audio Season 7 finale guest, as well as some really big news about upcoming live editions of the program. That's the hook to get you to stick around till the very end of the show, but I know what you are tuning in for right now is this compelling conversation, which you are about to hear as we welcome a longtime friend of the program, Bill Burns, for a discussion on his new book, Dr. Feelgood, the shocking story of the doctor who may have changed history by treating and drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and other prominent figures. Over the course of the next 2+ hours, we are going to learn all about the infamous Dr. Max Jacobson, who administered methamphetamine shots to some of the biggest Hollywood stars of the 1950s and 60s, as well as provided treatment for JFK during both his presidential campaign and presidency. We will dig deep into this amazing story as Bill shares a wealth of stunning anecdotes about the unseen influence of Dr. Feelgood on politics and pop culture. Additionally, we will spend the final third of the conversation in a jam session talking about the state of UFO research, disclosure, the citizens' hearing on disclosure, and where UFO research needs to go if it is going to unlock the enigma of unidentified flying objects. Altogether, it is a breathtaking edition of the program, which will have you looking at American history in a whole new light as we learn about Dr. Feelgood, Max Jacobson, with our friend Bill Burns. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Bill Burns, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. William J. Burns is a New York Times bestselling author, a magazine publisher, and a New York literary publishing agent who has written and edited over 25 books and encyclopedias in the fields of human behavior, true crime, current affairs, history, psychology, business, computing, and the paranormal. Bill Burns is the publisher of the nationally distributed UFO magazine. He was the editor of the UFO Encyclopedia published by Pocket Books and he was, of course, one of the stars of the History Channel's TV program, UFO Hunters. Bill Burns received his PhD from New York University in 1974 while he was an instructor of English at Trenton State College in New Jersey, where he taught structural linguistics and historical linguistics, as well as literature and writing. Professor Burns was a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellow, a Lilly Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, and a Grants Award Judge for the National Endowment for the Arts. Along with his wife, he hosts the weekly podcast Future Theater, which you can find at futuretheater.com. And you can find out more from Bill Burns at the website www.ufomag.com. Pretty simple, all one word, ufomag.com. Check it out. And with all that said, my friends, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on June 10th, 2013. Bill Burns, talking about Dr. Feelgood, Max Jacobson, on BOA Audio, Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio, Season 7. And as we head towards the close of this season, I wanted to bring back a longtime friend of the program, and he is the co-author of a fantastic new book, which I just finished this afternoon, and it is titled Dr. Feelgood, The Shocking Story of the Doctor Who May Have Changed History by Treating and Drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and Other Prominent Figures. And he co-authored the book with Richard Lertzman. And, of course, I'm talking about our good friend. This may surprise people because it's so far outside of the realm that they have previously heard him on this program. But, of course, he has authored numerous true crime-style books as well. I'm talking about our longtime friend, Bill Burns, of UFO Hunters and UFO Magazine fame. And, as I said, I absolutely love this book. It is riveting. And I've heard Bill on other programs talking about it, and I knew we had to get him on Banal of America Audio, because this is just right in our wheelhouse, this topic and this discussion. So I'm really excited about this and thrilled to be reconnecting with him here on Season 7. So welcome back to the program, Bill.
Oh, thank you, Tim. My pleasure.
I guess, you know, folks are, obviously, they know your bio, your background. You've been on the program a couple times now. I guess take us through sort of the background on the book. How did this come about, and, you know, how did you end up being a part of Dr. Feelgood?
Well, this book has really been kind of like 8 years in the making. when we were still in California and was working on UFO Magazine, this is even before UFO Hunters started. UFO Hunters actually started in 2006 is when we first assembled, and then in 2007 we did the pilot. But all the way back in 2005, 2006, Rick had called me. I had represented Dwayne Hickman. Dwayne Hickman was Dobie Gillis on the old Many Loves of Dobie Gillis show, the Max Schulman character. And I had, and he was also in the movie Rally Around the Flag Boys, the Max Schulman movie. But he was also on a show called Love That Bob, the Bob Cummings show. Love That Bob was about this photographer, playboy, you know, young Bob Cummings, and folks who want to see the definitive Bob Cummings should look at the Alfred Hitchcock movie Saboteur, look at Dial M for Murder. He was one of Hitchcock's favorite characters, character actors. And he was a big star, an A-list star in the 40s. And he was in this great movie with Ronald Reagan, one of the big cult movies of the 40s called King's Road, in which he and Reagan climb into bed together. Really a weird scene. Anyway, that was Bob Cummings. Bob Cummings, from being A-list motion picture star, feature film star, A-list television star, had this precipitous, I mean, just a fall from great heights to where he was kind of wallowing around at a motion picture home for impoverished actors up in the San Fernando Valley. And the reason was he was an addict. He was a methamphetamine addict. And how did he get that way? All the way back in the late 1950s, his agent, one of the agents, Blanche Gaines, who was a big agent in Hollywood, represented Patty Chayefsky, Rod Serling, Reginald Rose, and these were all the great names of 1950s dramatic television,
yeah.
Right? I mean, Patty Chayefsky, of course, went on to write one of the most definitive cult movies of all time, Network, back in the 70s, wrote Hospital, wrote The Americanization of Emily. So he was a very important, 12 Angry Men, very important playwright. And that agent introduced all these people to this doctor in New York called Max Jacobson. And Max Jacobson was giving out these vitamin elixir shots, right? These special vitamin shots. They were really 30 milligrams to 40 milligrams of methamphetamine, which made you feel great until you hit the wall and needed another shot, and then you fell into this unbelievable depression. So that's what Max Jacobson did. That was his stock in trade. He was giving those shots. And basically, once you took it, methamphetamine is a chemically habit-forming drug, okay? It's not like, oh, gee, you're a pothead, you can't go through a day without smoking pot. That's not at all like that. It is chemically habit-forming. What that means is the methamphetamine molecule, that the shape of that molecule, human chemicals in the human body, where they hit nerve endings,
yeah.
This is all, it's like there's a topography of chemicals in the human body.
Yeah.
Okay? It's the shape of certain molecules that hit certain receptors in the human body.
Okay.
Methamphetamine imitates dopamine.
Yeah.
And so as a result, when that is circulating through the bloodstream, it's taken up, it's called uptake, by receptors in the brain that generate, that respond to pleasure. That's in the amygdala, in the old animal part of the brain. And so as a result, an injection of methamphetamines stimulates dopamine flow, and dopamine is the feel-good neurochemical, right? And that hits the part of the brain that stimulates pleasure, and sure enough, people feel extraordinary pleasure. In higher doses, it's not just pleasure, it's a sense of invincibility. So it's hypergrandiosity, you become delusionally paranoid, hypersexual, you just want to have sex with everybody you see, regardless of sex, of gender. And so the people who began receiving these methamphetamine injections became paranoid, delusional, but on the other hand, the other side of the coin from paranoia and delusions of hypergrandiosity is clinical depression, severe hopelessness. And that's ultimately where you go with this drug. And that's where Bob Cummings went to until he was useless at the end of his life. He was impoverished, divorced. Even this woman who was Milton Berle brought to take care of him, left him.
Yeah, that was just
all
sad.
Alone.
Yeah.
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 So,
the girl from the Piggly Wiggly, right?
Right, from the Piggly Wiggly in Tennessee. So when Rick Lerspin came to me, I want to write the biography of Robert Cummings. And so we talked about it, and the reason he came to me with this originally was that he'd spoken to Duane Hickman. Duane was an eyewitness to Bob Cummings getting these injections.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when they were in New York, Cummings took a young Duane Hickman to Max Jacobs' office on the Upper East Side in the 70s and said, "You want a shot? Max will give you a shot." He said, no. Duane was smart enough not to get hooked. So it was Duane who began telling the story to Rick Lertzman about Dr. Jacobson. And so when Rick was asking about more about Cummings, I had represented Duane Hickman's book, Forever Dopey, that was published by Carroll Publishing. So Duane said, "Well, why don't you talk to Bill Burns? Because Bill Burns is my agent, but Bill Burns' godfather was George Burns, who hired Bob Cummings in Love That Bob." Now, I have a whole show business background through my father and my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So Rick called me up and we began talking about it. And in the conversation, I said, that was the same doctor who got Jack Kennedy hooked on methamphetamines. That was one of the big scandals that came out after Kennedy. I mean, decades after Kennedy was the Jacobson story.
Yeah.
And so he said, "Yeah, that's right." I said, "Well, with all the other stars involved, and this is a great story of Bob Cummings, but he's only part of the story. The real story is all the people who were addicted. And Rick said, fine. We began to investigate. He called other people. We spoke to Eddie Fisher. We spoke to a lot of stars. And, I mean, the stories about Liz Taylor that didn't get in the book because they were too gross would blow your mind. Because it was Eddie Fisher that got her addicted, his second wife. So Colonel Parker was an addict, and he got Elvis a shot. C.B. DeMille was an addict, and he got Charlton Heston a shot. So we began talking, and as the information coalesced around the arc of the story, it was clear when we realized that Max Jacobson himself was addicted to his own medicine, because Jacobson believed, as a lot of doctors did in the 1920s, by the way, you're going all the way back to the 1920s Berlin, which was really a hotbed of creativity. I mean, there was Einstein, there was Jung, there was Freud, there was this great surgeon, Dr. Beer. I mean, it was really a hotbed of medical research, both psychiatric and internal medicine research. Well, one of the things that a lot of the young med students were doing, and this guy Jacobson, as a young guy, was advocating, was you shouldn't be giving your patients any medication unless you tried the medication yourself. Fine. That runs contrary, by the way, to what the American Medical Association and medical licensing boards say. They say you can't medicate yourself.
Right.
You go to another doctor, get medicated. So Max began injecting himself with this concoction of like blood serum and eel cells and sheep gonads and human placentas and stem cells. I mean, it was just a mess. They made him so sick that he synthesized a drug that had been in existence since the end of the 19th century, which was an amphetamine. He synthesized that drug, added it to his vitamin elixir, because the whole point was to inject a substance into the blood that could cure neuromuscular disease, like multiple sclerosis.
Right.
But the methamphetamines made you, they masked the fact that this drug was making you sick. Ultimately, it's the methamphetamines you wanted. You didn't care about the sheep gonads.
Right.
Right? You care about the meth.
Exactly.
And that's what he did. And he became addicted to his own drug. And no. That's how this all began. So when we began researching, we realized this is a story about a drug. Yes, it's about Max Jacobson. Yes, it's about JFK and all the movie stars and stuff. But at the core of the story is how this drug, let's say for argument's sake, right, talking about UFO conspiracies.
Yeah.
Let's say for argument's sake that this drug, once synthesized, acts like a life form. Okay? What does a life form want to do? It really does three core things. It must find a host where it can live. Just like human beings, we have a host on planet Earth. We want to go to the moon, we need a host environment, i.e. a spacesuit. So it must find a host where it can live and thrive. It needs to multiply. It needs to expand itself. Human beings, you know, when we, for whatever reason, we got to planet Earth, whether we were brought here by an extraterrestrial, manipulated our DNA, whether the Bible's, whatever, the sanction in the Bible, the admonition in the Bible, is God says to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply. Well, we're in the midst on the East Coast of the brood 2 cicada 17-year cycle. What do? They come out of the earth, they copulate like crazy, they feed, and they die.
Right.
That's exactly what they do. They populate, they are fruitful, they multiply, and they die. And so the drug acts the same way. Not to sound really crazy, but look at how in the late 1940s, we were seeded with computer technology,
right?
Digital technology. Brittain and Shockley developed the transistor. We can go into that, down that rabbit hole. In 1947, 1948, and patented in 1949, again in 1950 as a consumer patent. And what have we done? How many times have you heard the story from someone, oh, the computer won't let me do it. The computer needs this information. The
yeah,
computer
yeah.
needs this. Right? I mean, who's the boss? Really? Who's the boss? You or the lousy computer? Sure enough, the computer, which ostensibly we created, think about this, we created this in our own image. It's got a hard drive, it's got a brain, it's got a central processor, right? Now it's telling us what to do. And that's how we're functioning. We become the drones of the computer. So this drug acted just like that. It infected Jacobson. Jacobson used that drug to infect others as he gradually spread his influence through show business, through the arts, and eventually into politics. And that's how this drug circulated. And that was the point of the book. It was a snapshot over time of how what essentially became a new life form, but this was a trade book, and it's not a UFO book, so we couldn't get too wacky, but how it permeated society. And look what that drug did. Jacobson became nothing less than a serial killer. He was a Soviet agent. He was turned in Vienna in the 1930s. And that Soviet agent, spied on by the CIA, because Mark Shaw, the photographer who was Jacobson's patient, was a CIA non-official cover officer, this guy killed him, killed Mark Shaw, killed Cecil B. DeMille, killed his own wife. He literally was a serial killer. Anybody who challenged him got an overdose of drugs and died.
Okay, that
and
kind
this
of,
was Max Jacobson.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, that was sort of like one of the first jumping-off points I wanted to talk about with you. Cause I couldn't really wrap my mind around how I felt about this guy, even as I finished the book, because he never really came across, except for the parts where it's sort of like veiled that maybe he went over the line to take some of these people out, but we don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't really ever sure if he was an evil person or just really misguided. Like, if he really thought he was doing good for all these people, or if he knew that he was just getting them hooked on you know, drugs.
Well, he knew he was getting them hooked on drugs.
Yeah.
That's first of all. So there was no innocent, oh, gee, were you addicted from his part? It was drugs.
Yeah.
But I think that if he had a benevolent aspect to him as a physician, that was quickly overtaken by the drug itself.
Okay, yeah.
Which drove him to spread that drug around. I mean, there's a story that wasn't in the book, but there's a story that after he'd gotten Sam Giancana, the mobster, hooked on the drug, Sam Giancana's girlfriend was Phyllis McGuire, from the McGuire sisters back in the 50s. And Max Jacobson, when Phyllis McGuire was on the old Ed Sullivan show, he was chasing her around backstage in the theater to give her a shot. That's how crazed this guy was. When Marilyn Monroe, who was an addict, she became a patient in the 1950s through Paula Strasberg, who was Lee Strasberg's wife at the Actors Studio. When she had to go on, she was not a live performer. She could only do movies. She had phenomenal stage fright. She wouldn't go on. So he gave her a mammoth shot of methamphetamines, and that's why she's slurring her speech and is acting drunk. She's not drunk. She's almost stuporous from methamphetamines. When Jackie Kennedy didn't want to do the White House tour after Jack Kennedy became president, they wanted her to do a tour of the White House. She refused. She said, I can't do it. I'm too afraid. She had stage fright. Max, she was already a patient of Max Jacobson. He was curing her from migraines after her miscarriage. And so he gave her a shot right before the show, and that's why she acts as stuporous as Marilyn Monroe in doing the White House tour.
Right, right. So it's like, it seems almost, I got the impression, and one of the overarching themes of the book is control.
Oh, yes.
Like, he wanted the control over these people. I guess extrapolate on that, 'cause like I was sort of, like, what was the control? Just the power that he was the only one who could, you know, help, quote unquote, these people, and he kind of collected the prominent figures in a sense in his mind.
Yeah, he was like the movie The Collector. One of the things that goes on is that you have these individuals who have control issues. It really is kind of I call it the serial killer syndrome, even though you don't have to be a serial killer to suffer from it. Serial killers like a Ted Bundy or a Jeffrey Dahmer, the issue is not the murder itself, as odd as that sounds to serial killers, but the issue is the control they exercise over the victim. So for Bundy, who's a necrophile, the killing was a means to control the victim. He'd go back and have sex with the body that he buried. Same with Dahmer. Dahmer would drug someone, have sex with the drugged person, then cannibalize the body and wear parts of the body on him because it was his form of exercising control. It's kind of I would say it's a psychiatric aberration, deep deviant psychiatric yeah. aberration, except for the fact that it's part of a spectrum. And we did this in the book Signature Killers with Bob Keppel. It's a spectrum in which, let's just say you've got a terribly bad boss who pops his ugly head into your, or her ugly head into your cubicle at work. And nothing you could do satisfies that boss. The boss's only happiness or apparent happiness is exercising control over you.
Right.
Do this. You did it wrong. Now do it again. Now do it again. You're going to get fired because you can't do it right. And you're doing it 16 different times to satisfy this boss. It's not you. It's the boss's own need to control. And that's what turns the boss into a tyrant. Well, at the extreme violent end of the spectrum, that's a serial killer.
Okay,
it's about control. Jacobson was on that spectrum of exercising control. And on the one hand, he was a tool of the drug, which sought to exercise control over the host. And the drug was a tool of Jacobson, who was injecting it to exert his control over other people.
Now, did any of these people, these celebrities and you know, any of the prominent figures, did they actually believe that this was just a simple vitamin mix, or were they kind of, was it kind of like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, that they knew that there was methamphetamines involved in all?
Two stories about that. One came from Bobby Kennedy, who Bobby Kennedy demanded, he stole vials of the medicine that Jacobson had given to JFK, and he took it to the FBI for analysis, and the FBI analyzed it and said, you know, what's in this stuff is a methamphetamine. It's nothing more than methamphetamines. Your brother's hooked. The president's hooked. Hence, the story got out among the FBI and the CIA that Kennedy was now a drug addict. So he knew. Kennedy knew because Bobby Kennedy told him. He said, you know, this is what you're taking. Look at this. This is what you're taking. And JFK said, I don't care if it's horse piss. It makes me feel good. The other person knew exactly what they were taking was the writer Rod Serling on Twilight Zone. One of the people we interviewed years ago, he died recently, was the script supervisor on Twilight Zone, whose name was Del Reisman. Del Reisman, Bob Cummings, who was Jacobson patient, we talked about Cummings, was on Twilight Zone in 1960 in the episode King Nine Will Never Return or something. You know, it's this story, I'm sure you've all seen it in the Twilight Zone retrospectives, of this B-24 Liberator bomber pilot who wakes up and it's actually after the war, but he's having this hallucination about the plane that's lost in the desert, and it's this spooky thing about this lost plane. Well, when they were filming that episode in this god-awful place in Barstow, California, I mean, it's out in the desert. So Serling and Bob Cummings are at this diner. They're having dinner, right? Serling is smoking up cigarettes like a chain. He's just smoking away, right? Cummings was a health nut. I mean, he'd actually written a book in the 50s about how to stay fit forever, and it's all about vitamins and nutrition and vegetables and working out, because it was a bestseller in the 1950s. And Cummings takes out a bunch of pills and puts them on his plate, and Serling goes, what the hell is that? And Cummings goes, well, that's my vegetable, that's my protein, that's my... And Serling's meal comes, right? Huge steak smothered in fat and onions and potatoes, and he's smoking cigarettes and drinking. And Cummings looks at Serling and says, you know, you eat like that, you treat yourself like that, you're going to be dead by the time you're 50. Sure enough, he died when he was 50, but you're going to be dead by the time you're 50. Serling says to Cummings, this is 1960 now, Serling says to Cummings, and the person at the dinner table is this guy, Del Reisman, the script supervisor for that show. Serling says to Cummings, hey, we both go to the same doctor. You both know the shit that he's giving us, so don't tell me about treating yourself well. Right? They knew.
Yeah. Now, we should note here, now, this... Was it legal?
Absolutely legal.
Okay, that's what I was going to say.
Methamphetamines in the 1950s and 60s, up until the early 1970s, was a completely legal drug. It had to be dispensed by prescription, just like it is now. I mean, what do you think is in Ritalin? What do you think is in Adderall? What do you think is some diet drugs? It's methamphetamines.
Yeah. But it was just more pervasive, I guess, in the raw form, if you will, kind of. It wasn't actually, it probably just hadn't been taken over by the pharmaceutical companies yet.
Well, it had not. Yeah, well, it was in Nazi Germany. A pharmaceutical company, I forget the name of the company, I think it wasn't ibuprofen, I'd love to blame them. But a company had taken over the drug from Max Jacobson, it was his formula, and was dispensing millions of capsules to Wehrmacht soldiers and the Luftwaffe. And the United States was dispensing it to our own pilots. And the British were dispensing it to RAF pilots. Because remember, absent jets, think of how long it would take to fly from north of London all the way to Schweinfurt or Frankfurt or Dresden or Berlin.
Yeah, so it could be administered by a doctor. It wasn't like something that we're not talking about the because when people hear meth now, they think of like hillbillies in bathtubs and that, the shit that's going on, that terrible sort of scourge.
Right, meth labs that blow up in your face. No, this was long before that, and this wasn't crystal meth. It wasn't rock, like a rock crystal meth. This was liquid methamphetamines.
Okay. Yeah, and I was just amazed, too, reading the book, just how much this guy was bringing in, you know, at his height. Like, I think they said they were like, you know, syringes, like thousands of syringes, 1,500
right.
syringes a week.
When he was investigated by New York State, they were appalled at the amount of instruments this guy had, at the amount of drugs he was making, at the number of instruments he had. They said, you couldn't possibly have this small a patient list and be dispensing that many drugs. And they were right. He was pushing drugs around the world.
Absolutely. Just crazy stuff. Just absolutely crazy stuff. And like I said, having talked to you now and having read the book, it definitely, you get the picture of a guy who was overcome by the drug itself, that he probably knew that this was a terrible thing to be doing, but he was part of the disease, if you will.
He convinced himself at a certain point that because the drug was, I mean, he actually said, do I want to be called Dr. Feel Bad? No, I want to be called Dr. Feel Good. That's what I make people. I make them feel good. So he saw himself delusional on this mission to make people feel good.
The repeated use of this stuff, it's not like, it'll really mess you up pretty bad, your body, right?
Well,
I mean, that's kind of what
John F. Kennedy Jr. told us. He actually told C. David Heyman, who got to us with this story, that John F. Kennedy Jr. blamed Max Jacobson's methamphetamines for his mother's, Jackie's, terminal lymphoma, acute lymphoma.
Right. So it's kind of like one of those things like that's akin to like steroids, where it's like, you know, it'll make you big and strong, but then, you know, your body will fall apart on the inside and fall apart.
That's exactly right.
Just absolutely madness. Now, obviously, this was known about by him and sort of like the medical community, but was it kind of like another thing where it's sort of like how in the 80s coke was everywhere, but no one really talked about it kind of thing?
It
like,
was.
Like in the mainstream where people weren't like, oh, you know, celebrities are all secretly doing meth or anything like that, right?
No, they didn't talk about it, but they did it. I mean, and this goes back to the 1930s in Paris when he was concocting this stuff. I mean, people like Anna Isnin, the writer Anna Isnin, she got Henry Miller hooked on it. Anna Isnin was talking about how she had various croups and coughs and this and that, and Jacobson gave her a shot. She said, I felt like I was on fire, and then suddenly all my symptoms disappeared, and they had to go back and get more. So, I mean, this is actually what happened as far back as the 30s. They just felt so good that whatever it was, they didn't care.
Yeah. Crazy. It's just amazing. I'm completely blown away just by how how pervasive this was, and just sort of like how permissible it was, you know, that it was. But I guess I shouldn't be, because I drew the comparison to the cocaine, you know, widespread cocaine use in the 80s. It seems kind of like it was a precursor to that whole thing. So.
Well, it was. I mean, and this really was. When 1973-74 rolled around, this was the basis for Nixon's starting the war on drugs.
Right.
The scandal when this broke in the New York Times and on WABC and IMS Radio, when this stuff broke, Geraldo was one of the big crusaders about Geraldo Rivera. Oh, when this story broke all over the place, it was such a scandal. And of course, Nixon had asked for these objections from Max Jacobson, because he and Kennedy were friends in the Senate, and he knew Kennedy was taking the drug. And Jacobson turned him down and said, no, you're an alcoholic. You can't have these drugs. They're counterindicative with alcohol.
And let's sort of dive into the Kennedy connection, because that's a big part of the book. And you know, you sort of introduce the idea that, you know, it may not necessarily have been the core reason behind the assassination, but it certainly sort of fueled the feelings that Kennedy needed to be taken out, because he was becoming completely unpredictable and dangerous as he became more addicted.
I agree with you. He was at that point by 1963, early 63, he was a phenomenal danger in the eyes of the CIA. I mean, he'd become a danger. Public didn't know about it, but there were a whole bunch of things that happened. On the one hand, all the people inside the administration knew that Kennedy was taking drugs from this doctor. And in the book, you'll see a letter in the photo section that Kennedy had asked his doctor, Janet Travell, to write saying he was in perfect health and fit to be president. He wasn't. He had a fatal disease. That disease was called Addison's disease, a disease of the adrenal system, and that was killing him. He had Crohn's disease, also called irritable bowel syndrome. He had a severe back injury from World War II. This guy was on 5 injections of Novocaine a day. He was on constant phenobarbital for a muscle relaxant for the irritable bowel syndrome. He was on antidepressants, very early forms of them, and then he got addicted to methamphetamines. So he was literally a walking pharmaceutical cesspool.
Right, right.
And everybody around him knew it, including LBJ, by the way. But they all knew it. Okay?
Right. Kind of like the FDR in the wheelchair situation.
Right. But, of course, the press looked the other way. Like, oh, Kennedy hurt his back in the war. He's got to sit in a rocking chair. Oh, that poor man, that poor man. The guy walked on crutches when he wasn't in the media. So, I mean, for all the youthful vigor that he represented, he was really physically a sick guy. What the drugs did was, as they became more pervasive, and remember, Jackie was his second wife. He was married to some German spy before that, but it was annulled. Kennedy became hypersexual from the drugs. And literally, if it walked, he wanted it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That was Kennedy. And it went so far by 1962 that Kennedy was making appointments with call girls who lived around Central Park so he could slip away from his Secret Service detail. Imagine this.
Jesus.
You slip away from your Secret Service detail, go to some call girl's apartment for sex. And the CIA was thinking, what if the Soviets knew? They did, and the CIA knew the Soviets knew. And what if they were competent enough to plant one of their spies as a call girl, hooking up with Kennedy, and Kennedy gets he's either kidnapped. Then they realized, when they tapped Marilyn Monroe's phone about Operation Bluefly and Moonbeam and those two, they were the two files that non-earthly objects that fall from space were filed under, Moonbeam and Bluefly.
Yeah.
So Kennedy's, so Marilyn Monroe, who's patient, threatens Kennedy by saying she'll talk about things that come down from outer space that are over in Area 51. She didn't call it that. She said that secret air base in Nevada.
Right.
The CIA now knows that Kennedy is doing pillow talk. He's speaking out of school. So not only is he having sex with a bunch of women, not only is he on this drug methamphetamines, not only is he taking LSD that another mistress, Mary Meyer, was bringing in from Timothy Leary, but the guy's slipping away from the Secret Service detail and spilling state secrets to Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
And God knows who else.
And additionally, with all the sort of psychoses and stuff that
right.
are fueled by the methamphetamine, you got the guy, you know, he's got his finger on the button, so you don't know what he could do if he...
So in 1962, you knew there'd be a Corso moment. So in 1962, Phil Corso is, he's leaving the armed service, he's retiring, and he testifies before the Senate Judiciary Committee, right? And what he's testifying to, and Corso was no radical liberal. If anything, he was way on the other side. He testifies to the CIA's manipulating what are called NIEs, National Intelligence Estimates. These are the official intelligence reports estimating what types of things are going on in the world. These are NIEs. Corso is testifying to his assertion as a member of Army G2 intelligence and his whole history that the CIA, which he considers an enemy, is doctoring the NIEs for political purposes. So it's not just that they're saying what's real and what they believe is true, it's what they believe the government wants to hear to serve their own interests. And that's what he accuses them of in Senate testimony that is classified. I have a copy of the testimony. In the middle of that testimony, Corso reveals that the CIA, and I've heard this story from other places too, but this is it. This is in Senate testimony that the CIA is fronting for drug lords in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and laundering money for narco traffickers, for drug growers, drug harvesters. Well, that's like fundamental, classified. Bobby Kennedy hears about this testimony. He's still Attorney General. He hears about this testimony, and he says, I want a copy of this testimony.
Right.
Corso says, I will only allow you to see it, because they gave him the right to determine who gets to read it and who doesn't. I will let you see it if and only if you promise to turn this over to your brother as raw testimony. Bobby Kennedy agrees. I saw the sign out slip, Bobby Kennedy's signature on it. Turns it over to Jack Kennedy. It's now 1963. And Kennedy realizes that, now remember, in 1954, flashback 10 years, in 1954, the French Foreign Legion fortified camp, right, fortified base at Dien Bien Phu is surrounded and falls to Viet Minh.
Yeah.
Right? And that forces the French out. At that base, Dien Bien Phu, there was a small group of United States Marines. Eisenhower would not support the French in Vietnam. He religiously kept us out of wars in Southeast Asia. He's the guy who did the armistice in Korea in 1953. So he's not going to get back into a war in Vietnam on the side of the French. I mean, the hell with Vietnam. Who cares?
Right.
Diem is involved in drugs. Madame Nu is involved in drugs. Kennedy makes a decision in 1963 to do a couple of things. One, pull U.S. advisors out. The Marines were advisors in 54. Pull U.S. advisors out of Vietnam completely. Withdraw backing from the Diem regime. That resulted in the coup. Withdraw backing from the Diem regime and get us out of Vietnam. But also, he's realizing that the CIA has paramilitary in Southeast Asia. He basically terminates the role of the paramilitary cuts the paramilitary off. Now we know the CIA has extensive paramilitary in Asia, right, in the Middle East right now.
Right.
But he cuts it out, and he basically creates the Special Forces, the Green Berets, and Navy SEALs. In other words, he takes covert military operations. Okay, that's the bigger picture. He takes them out of the hands of the Central Intelligence Agency. And this is going on right now before our eyes. He takes it out of the CIA and migrates it over to the Pentagon with two new army commands, two new military commands, one for the Navy, one for the Army.
Right.
Okay.
Now, in Vietnam.
We're seeing this right now with what's his face, Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense, now tasked, and this guy, what's his face, Brennan, now who's at the CIA, now tasked with taking the drone wars, as much as they can do that, out of the CIA and putting them under Pentagon jurisdiction. So they're putting them into the bureaucracy of the military. This is a repeat of 1963. So what happens is now the CIA – now, why was the CIA in South Asia? One was, of course, they were laundering drug money. They didn't get enough money in their black budget. They needed more money, so they were getting paid by drug lords. That's one. Two, there's oil in the South China Sea and in the Southeast Asia. How do we know that? It goes back to the Japanese in the 1930s. The Japanese wanted the Southeast Asia oil. That's what they wanted. Why? The Japanese were a big naval power. In Japanese military thinking, since they're an island nation, like Great Britain, they're an island nation, right?
Right.
An island nation must rely on its navy, right? The British and the Spanish Armada.
Exactly.
You rely on your navy to defend yourself. That's the Japanese view of war. The Japanese view of war, circa 1920s, is that you fight a major naval sea battle. That's how they defeated the Soviets Soviet-Japanese War. You fight a major sea battle, defeat the other's navy, and they can't invade you. So the Japanese, in order to pursue their empire, their imperial claims, they invaded China, and they were advancing from China across the mountains, it's called the Burmese Hump, into Burma, into Southeast Asia for oil.
Right.
Right? They needed oil to prosecute a war. The United States was bombing the Japanese. Remember Clara Chenault and the Flying Tigers? And that was a covert United States military operation to bomb the Japanese to prevent them from reaching the Southeast Asia oil fields. That was one of the reasons for Pearl Harbor. The Japanese wanted an agreement with the U.S. You stay off our side of the Pacific, and we're not going to bother you. And the U.S. said, you're an Axis power. We're not going to let you do that.
Yeah.
And they're negotiating. And so that's the importance of oil in Southeast Asia. Well, that's not lost on the United States. The CIA wanted control for the United States of that oil. So to let North Vietnam invade the South and turn the whole region communist, the domino theory, right? South Vietnam, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, for that, we needed to stop the North Vietnamese to preserve the one deep water port in that whole area, deep enough for tankers, heavy capacity tankers. What was the name of that port? Haiphong.
Okay.
Therefore, it was vital that for us that we keep that port. So when Kennedy said, I'm pulling us out, the CIA freaked out. That's only then the other element happening, this is 1963, is that the Bobby Baker scandal was taking place in the Senate. And Bobby Baker worked for none other than Lyndon Johnson, who was Senate Majority Leader. And as the Bobby Baker scandal, as the whole scandal began to unravel in the Senate, Bobby Kennedy knew that LBJ could not be on the 1964 reelection ticket. Couldn't happen. the CIA knew that Kennedy was not only slipping away from the Secret Service guards, but that he was talking out of school, and now he directly affected the CIA's entire program by pulling him out of Southeast Asia, cutting them off from drug money. So they realized, in their perception of things, that Kennedy was a phenomenal liability to them. And he wouldn't even live anyway through his second term because of Addison's disease. So they went to LBJ and they said, remember the game Monopoly, Mr. Vice President? You can go to jail right now and not collect your $200. Or you could go to the White House and collect far more than $200. Here's how. And LBJ signed on to make sure that whatever happened to Kennedy was covered up. And that's how the assassination plot began. CIA inspired. The Cubans hated Kennedy because of the Bay of Pigs. Great, let's get somebody from the Cubans. The mob hated Kennedy because Joe Kennedy, who was running booze into New York Harbor with Meyer Lansky, remember Murder Incorporated?
Uh-huh.
Meyer Lansky, and the Bronfmans of Seagram's, Canadians, running that booze in, had made a deal with Sam Giancana for the Cook County vote. If you remember back to 1960, Kennedy was losing the popular vote. It was so close. It was in the wee hours. But when Cook County reported in Illinois, that swung the electoral votes in Illinois. That put Kennedy over the top, and that's how Kennedy won the election. That deal, Joe Kennedy saying to Sam Giancana, you give me the Cook County vote, I will keep you guys free from federal investigations. Well, as soon as Bobby Kennedy becomes Attorney General, what happens? The McClellan Senate organized crime hearings, the Jimmy Hoffa story. Bobby Kennedy basically didn't go with the plan.
Right.
So under President Kennedy, the mob was in a lot of trouble. So you had the mob involved. You had the CIA, you had the mob, you had the Cubans. And you had LBJ. And that was the chemistry for getting shooters to take out Kennedy in Johnson's backyard.
Right.
And that was in part fueled by how crazy Kennedy was acting under the influence of Max Jacobson's methamphetamines.
Right. Let's circle back sort of and talk about how he deteriorated under the influence of the meth. Because that sort of informs this story, if you will, because that explains how it, and in a way, he's becoming unstable. The CIA sees it. And you got to imagine probably that he probably mentally isn't all there as far as sort of like keeping his guard up, if you will. It sounds like his brother was the one who was kind of watching out for him, and he sounds like he's just willy-nilly doing drugs and banging women and blowing terrible deals, summits with the Russians and stuff like that. It's like he doesn't know what he's doing.
That's the other aspect. That in Vienna, in 1961, Kennedy is high on drugs during the summit with Khrushchev. Really high on drugs. And remember, Khrushchev knew that Jacobson had been turned by the Soviets in the 1930s. So they've got a man injecting a very powerful drug into the president. Before the Vienna summit, and Kennedy had invited Jacobson, didn't invite him, ordered him to accompany him on the summit because he needed those injections to stay focused. It's as if he were taking Ritalin, right?
Yeah.
So he needed it to stay focused. He invites Jacobson. So Khrushchev has an appointment, right? They're going to meet in this conference room in Vienna. Khrushchev doesn't show up. Kennedy had taken his injection, and now he was coming down from it, and he wanted more. So he says to Jacobson, Max, I need more drug. I'm feeling woozy. You gotta shoot me up again. Jacobson says, Mr. President, I cannot do this. I've already given you the max dose you can handle. Too much more, and you're going to be unable to function. You're going to become stuporous. I'm the president. I'm ordering you to inject me again. They're still waiting for Khrushchev. He injects him again. Khrushchev shows up, and Kennedy is stunned. stumbling around nearly stuporous. Khrushchev looks at him and says, this little wimp, this little puppy dog, is nothing. I could roll this guy over. And he beats Kennedy up, and Kennedy admits it. He says to James Reston of the New York Times, when he goes back to Berlin, he says, it was the worst day of my life. I was beaten up. He treated me like a child. Kennedy was acting like a child, a drunken child.
Yeah.
So shortly after that, Khrushchev, knowing, by the way, here's the deal. Here's like the big secret. The Soviets in 1962-61 did not have intercontinental ballistic missiles. They had missiles. They had intermediate range ballistic missiles, but they couldn't reach the United States. So Khrushchev needed an angle to threaten the United States, to get the United States. He needed something to come back to the Soviets with. And that was to get Kennedy to take missiles out of Turkey. So he begins installing missiles in Cuba. Now, the Soviet parliament, the Supreme Soviet, doesn't know that they don't have intercontinental ballistic missiles. Khrushchev lied by saying they did. So Kennedy at first, and the CIA, this is right in front of the CIA, knows that the missiles are going to Cuba, and the National Reconnaissance Office, has photographs of these missiles. Kennedy knows the missiles are there, but he's going to make believe they're not. Oh, I'm not going to look. I'll look the other way. What do I care? 90 miles from Florida, there are Soviet missiles.
Yeah.
Corso hears from the NRO, he's got friends there because he was in intelligence for so long, that he sees the photographs. So what he does is he goes to one of these columnists in Boston and blows the whistle on the missiles. So Kennedy's on his way to Hyannisport, right? The story pops up, and I think it's the Boston Globe. I'm not sure which paper it was, but it, and then a couple of congressmen, Mike Feigin, another one, gets the story. They start saying the Soviets have missiles in Cuba, right? So the Air Force One makes a U-turn, heads back to D.C., and that's the big crisis. So again, this was so serious because we had to confront the Soviets directly on these missiles, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is so serious. How serious was it? This was so serious that this interceptor, Air Force interceptor pilot, George Merritt, who was flying out of Edwards when he was on UFO Hunters, was sitting down. He's saying, do you know that in 1962, during the missile crisis, the Air Force was scrambling interceptors because they believed that the Soviet bomber fleet would fly over Alaska and attack the United States. And so they were assembling interceptor squadrons to confront them. So what we would do is we would fly up over the Bering Straits, hit our failsafe points, right, circle around and come back. And this has been done, by the way, ever since the end of World War II. So, but he said, and this is the, for me, it was the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
When we were flying over Alaska, over the whole northwestern United States, we were carrying nuclear-tipped air-to-air missiles. The plan was, and this is the second time I've heard this, the plan was you see the Soviet bomber fleet, you fire your nuclear missiles over the Bering Straits and get the hell out and get back and get more.
Oh,
they're flying nuclear weapons over the United States mainland, and they knew that some of those bombers would get through with Soviet missiles, with guided missiles. Now, again, little-known story, not really covered. You don't see this thing turning up a lot, but that's what this guy told me. So that's how serious this was in 1962, all brought to that point by a drugged-out Kennedy who couldn't stand up to Khrushchev, who believed that Kennedy could be rolled over like some bum in the street.
Right.
That's Jacobson.
Oh, my God. It's just amazing. Now, did he... Well, this wasn't really covered in the book at all, but I was kind of wondering, you know, his association with Kennedy was sort of like the pinnacle of his, you know, professional and personal life. Like, he was
absolutely
was the greatest thing that ever happened to him. What was his reaction when Kennedy was killed? Was he distraught? Did he blame himself at all? You know, how did he react to all that?
He was stunned. I mean, remember, Jacobson's whole issue was he's blameless. I didn't do this. He's blameless.
Right.
He actually said to Kennedy, there's a story in the book about after Bobby Kennedy knew what kind of drugs his brother was taking, he confronted Jacobson and Jacobson's friend, Congressional Medal of Honor winner Mike Samick, who was a pilot in World War II, he worked for the OSS, threw him out of the White House, said, get back to New York, get out of here, we don't want you here.
Right.
Jacobson was so upset that he resigned as Kennedy's doctor. That's why Kennedy brought him to the Carlisle Hotel off Central Park, convinced him, he even asked him to move into the White House, give up his medical practice, be the Kennedy's personal, full-time, 24/7 physician living in the family quarters of the White House on the second floor. And Jacobson said, no, I've got patients. I got my MS patients. But so, yeah, Jacobson was stunned when Kennedy was killed. But remember, at that point, in 1963, Jacobson was awash in show business stuff.
Right.
And he was seeing people getting killed. Marilyn Monroe had died the year before.
Mm-hmm.
He knew. I mean, Cecil B. DeMille had died. Marilyn Monroe had died. I mean, he knew that an excess of his drugs were killer. He knew that.
Right.
That's why he was trying to control the dosage. Kennedy didn't die from an injection. He died because the injections made him so psychotic that the CIA no longer believed that Kennedy could function as a president without getting us into another world war.
Right. Well, it seems like even though he saw that these people that he was drugging were dying, it didn't seem to affect his...
No, it didn't.
He didn't seem to warn them or anything. It wasn't like he was... Well, I'm sure he kind of warned them about dosage and stuff like that, but he wasn't like, hey, you know, this could kill you eventually if you don't...
That's exactly right.
Straighten up.
Precisely right, yeah.
No, we know what became of Jacobson. We'll get into that in a little bit. But, like, all these people are hooked on this, on these drugs and shit, so what happens... I think in the book, I think it was Milton Berle, but I don't know exactly who, but he says, you know, drug, it was funny, it's so antiquated, he said drug confrontations, and then in brackets, it's like interventions, which is what he means.
Right.
It's like there were no interventions back then, and it seemed like if they wanted to fix somebody up, they threw him in like a psych ward for like
Well, that's what happened with Bob Cummings.
Right.
That's exactly what happened. His family, again, the longer story is, that Bob Cummings' really good friend was this famous TV host, real personality, big in the 50s, Art Linkletter, right? House Party, Children Say the Funniest Things, right? That guy, okay?
It was Linkletter that said that about interviews.
Linkletter, right. So Jacobson's son, Tommy Jacobson, went to the Cummings' children. Bob had already been divorced from their mother, and he said, do you know what drugs your father is getting? And he explained the drugs. Bob Cummings was at this point psychotic. So they prevailed on Linkletter to set up this supposedly a party for Cummings. And what really happened was it was the men in the white coats. And they came to take him away. Literally, they showed up with a van, put him in a straitjacket, off he went. So Cummings is now institutionalized. He's no money. The IRS has seized all of his assets. His wife has divorced him. And he's in a mental institution. And he prevails on Linkletter to get him out, which Linkletter does. So that was the nature of the intervention.
Right. Is that kind of what happened to a lot of these folks, where they sort of like maybe, you know, step back and dried out, if you will? Because obviously a lot of these people that he got hooked on this stuff, you know, they went on to live fairly productive lives. So they must not have... Unless, you know, they must have somehow found a way out of the morass.
Well, I mean, they were marginally productive lives. I mean, Rod Serling lived a very productive life, but he died at 50.
That's true, yeah.
Right? I mean, Bob Cummings, his career fell like a rock because of Jacobson. In fact, the story is that Bob Cummings became so hyper-grandiose that now he's doing a series with a Julie Newmar, right? Catwoman.
Uh-huh.
He's doing a series with her called My Living Doll. She's a robot, and he's a scientist. It's supposed to be a love interest, right?
Right, kind of like to be like I Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched.
Yeah,
right?
I Dream of Jeannie,
kind of,
you know, like a modern Isaac Asimov version of Pygmalion, right? So Cummings is getting upset because, I mean, here's Cummings, who's, you know, not exactly a young, handsome playboy, right?
Uh-huh.
Older guy now. And he's supposed to be falling in love with this robot. And Julie Newmar, I mean, one of the roles she played before the show was she was this character from Lil Abner called Stupefying Jones, this mammothly beautiful woman. We met her. We interviewed Julie Newmar. And Julie Newmar said that Bob Cummings was getting angrier and angrier because all the fans were looking at Julie Newmar. She was the star of the show. Cummings was supposed to be the star of the show, so Cummings was so mad. He began to want a bigger part in the show. So again, fueled by these drugs, he commissions a script for My Living Doll, which he's takes more of a role. Then he challenges the head of CBS, whose name was Jack Aubrey. Jack Aubrey's nickname was the Snake. And he was nicknamed the Snake because while he was shaking your hand and telling you how wonderful you were doing, he was busy injecting venom into your back and killing you. That was Jack Aubrey. Jack Aubrey was the guy who fired my godfather, Jack Benny, from television. He says to Jack Benny, right, one of the biggest vaudeville stars, one of the biggest radio stars. He says to Benny, your career is done. You'll never be on television again. He says that to him. So when Bob Cummings goes to Aubrey and says, this is the script I want. If you don't do this script, I'm walking. Aubrey says, that's right. You're not walking, you're thrown out. And not only are you thrown out, but I'm going to spread the word throughout the industry that you're toxic, you're a drug addict, you're on methamphetamines. Nobody will hire you. You'll die a bum. And that was the end of Bob Cummings' television career.
Yeah, that guy, he really, that was kind of the sad turn of events, because you know, this guy's falling apart as it is, he's becoming an asshole. I mean, he can't really, you know, you kind of begrudgingly feel bad for the guy, but then it's like he's just wiped out from
right,
Hollywood.
And then Cummings tries to get Julie Newmar addicted. He shoots himself, I mean, she told me this story, she said, there's this guy, he's out in my dressing room, and he takes a needle, and he injects the stuff right into his ankle. Then he says, come on, I'll do you next. She says, not on your life.
Jesus. It's just wild stuff. Now, what, I was surprised to see that Jacobson's son was involved in some of the stuff on the West Coast. What became of him down the line?
Still alive.
First of all,
he blew the whistle on his father with the Bob Cummings family. Tommy Jacobson, we have him on tape. He's alive. He's like close to 90, I think, now.
Oh, wow.
But he became a medical doctor. He was born in Berlin, became a medical doctor. He treated Marilyn Monroe. He was giving her that substance right up until 1962.
Right, right. That's what I mean. He didn't seem to suffer a lot of the same fate as his father, though. Did he sort of roll over?
He did have remorse. He did have remorse of what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because I wasn't sure, because it never really, like I said, I was surprised to see this guy kind of had it on both coasts in a way through his son.
Oh, yeah.
It seemed like he was probably kind of using him in a way to facilitate the whole enterprise, if you will, to be his West Coast wing on all this.
Well, there was, I mean, these people on the West Coast, all the show business folks wanted the drug, and there were other doctors. I mean, there's this motion picture, this Blake Edwards motion picture, I think it's called SOB. Standard operating bullshit. And you see with Julie Andrews and in that movie, SOB, Robert Preston, remember the famous Robert Preston from Music Man, better known in the cult movie The Last Starfighter or whatever?
Uh-huh.
Preston is playing Dr. Feelgood, giving people meth shots at the party.
Well, that was good. What I was going to ask you, beyond Jacobson's son, was this a more prevalent thing than even we think? Were there more doctors doing this sort of thing?
Yep. There were a lot of doctors picking up on this as meth became the gotta have drug in Hollywood. Because it before there was cocaine, before there was cocaine powder, it was meth that gave you that feeling of hyper grandiosity that allowed you to achieve what you could achieve. I mean, years ago, Joe Martin and I wrote the book, Haunting of the President, eons ago, right?
Yeah.
And, In the book, we're talking about why Ronald Reagan ultimately came to rely on psychic and astrologer Joan Quigley to cast his a chart and pick the most propitious days to do presidential things. The whole White House in the 80s was run by this person, Joan Quigley, an astrologer.
Yeah.
Right? It's like Pharaoh's wise man, right? Pharaoh's prophets running the White House. When the plane should take off, when he should wind up in Iceland, when he should talk to, Gorbachev, right?
Mm-hmm.
The story goes that Vice President George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, sees that Air Force One is taking off at these odd hours, like 5:03 and 32 seconds to go. And finally he goes to Mike Deaver, who is on the president's staff, chief of staff. He says to Deaver, why? I don't understand these oddball hours in the president's schedule. And Deaver says, don't you know? Haven't you heard? The whole White House is being run by an astrologer, Joan Quigley. And Bush just rocks back in his chair and goes, oh, my God. Right? And one of the reasons we explain for this, why Nancy, it was Nancy Reagan, why Nancy Reagan involved Joan Quigley is that, and this is a true story, in Hollywood, making a motion picture, making a television series, doing something in Hollywood is as impossible to do as a bumblebee's flying, right? Nobody knows how a bumblebee can fly because it's un-aerodynamic to the max, same with hummingbirds, okay? So you use every angle you can use, and one of those angles was the paranormal. Presidents used them all the way since Franklin Pierce, right, in the White House, when having a channeler. Abraham Lincoln brought in Nettie Coburn to invoke a ghost that would tell him to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. You didn't see that in the movie Lincoln, did you? But that's a true story. So that's what goes on. Well, drugs and cocaine in Hollywood in the 80s was that kind of thing, but that's what methamphetamines were in the 1960s and 70s in Hollywood.
Right, right. So it wasn't just Jacobson, it was just this widespread thing, but he had the most high-profile clients of all.
He did, and the more patients screamed, the more Jacobson would oblige them. And we see this exactly what happened today with this Dr. Conrad Murray and Michael Jackson.
Right.
It was a dangerous drug he was injecting into Jackson, but Jackson wanted it, had to have it, couldn't function without it, Murray did it, and he died.
Exactly, yeah. Well, he was getting like 150 grand a month or something crazy like that. So
exactly.
He probably thought, hey,
do what your patient asks, and that's what these doctors did.
So it still continues to this day. It's just
the
drugs just changed, that's all.
It's just, yeah, the drug changed, the practice continues.
Talk a little bit about, because I thought this was really interesting, just to sort of get into the mind of Jacobson, you point out a few times just how, like, just crazy his office was, and how he was filthy and covered in blood, and, you know, all kind. You're just a strange dude. You know, people up until now in this conversation may have been imagining, you know, their sterile doctor's office situation, but it was so far removed from that scenario that it bears discussion. So talk a little bit about that.
Sure. And that was what was so ironic about Jacobson's office. First of all, the office was filthy. It was run out of his apartment, first of all. This wasn't a real medical office. It was his apartment. With an adjacent room as a waiting room. And Jacobson had a lab in the apartment. And the lab was literally this concoction of sheep gonads and blood serum and placentas and, you know, medical waste and, you know, stuff that today would be so toxic that a hazmat team would come in. Jacobson himself was filthy. He had a lab coat that was spattered with blood. He had track marks up and down his arm because he was injecting himself. He had blood serum all over the place. That was the office. Filthy. And that's what another reason why his license was pulled. When the medical examination board came in, they saw the office and said, this thing, you know, you can't run a medical practice out of this. It's filthy.
Right.
Get out of here. Well, the fascinating thing about circa 1970, Max Jacobson's office, actually circa 1960, because that's what Kennedy reacted to, too. He walks into the office because his roommate from Harvard, Chuck Spalding, right, you know those funny rubber balls? Spaulding's. Chuck Spaulding hooks him up with Jacobson. Kennedy is appalled by the state of Jacobson's office. I mean, it's filthy. It's sickened him. But he was sick. He was on his last legs. He was going to lose the election. He needed a boost. But Jacobson, all the way back in the 1920s in Berlin, one of the reasons he never became a surgeon, even though he had a surgery residency at this Hospital of Charity in Berlin, was that he felt that the operating room standards in the 1920s, since nobody used disinfectants, since there were no antibiotics, it's literally the operation was a great success. Too bad the patient died. They died from infections. We're seeing this now with superbugs, right? You went to the hospital for something, and you can contract an infection that's so bad, no antibiotic will fix it because the bacteria have evolved to the point where they're resistant to the antibiotics you're receiving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So Jacobson was so upset about the state of cleanliness and the antiseptic nature of operating rooms, he opted not to become a surgeon and went into internal medicine instead. Yet by the 40s and 50s and 60s, his office was a pigsty.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy, and it's remarkable. I guess it says a lot about the power of the drug, because you've got these powerful, you try to get into the mind of these people. You get these powerful, prominent entertainers and politicians, and, you know, if I walked into an office like that, I'd spin on my heel and walk out. But
of course.
You know, they're waiting around to get their shots. It's amazing.
Exactly. I mean, and you've got people like Truman Capote, like Tennessee Williams, who are living on these injections. I mean, people will say, oh, Tennessee Williams was a real big drug addict. Oh, this, oh, that. He was a meth addict. He was completely addicted to methamphetamines. That was Tennessee Williams. That was Truman Capote. And they wrote about it, and they promulgated it, and they brought other people to visit Jacobson. There were these parties in his office that would go on till 3 and 4 in the morning, and if you hung around the office, part of what you got from Max Jacobson was this powerful methamphetamine injection, and that's why they would hang around the office to get that injection.
Let's bring it back one more time to the Kennedy thing, because I think it bears also talking about the whole story about the debate, because that story has been, the debate itself has been immortalized as this amazing turning point in American political history and you know, a real historic sort of moment. And of course, as we learn from the book, there's Dr. Jacobson lurking in the background, really fueling what happened, which is
right.
Stunning.
I mean,
I'm amazed, just before I cut you, I don't mean to cut you off, but like, mm-hmm. I'm just amazed that, you know, I'm learning all this now, like, for the first time having read this book. You'd think that this thing would have been a movie by now, or that it would be more well known. It's stunning that these stories kind of still lurk in the background.
Well, there are two elements to this. Element one is that it would have been a movie by now. It would have been, you know, heavy-duty stuff, except that people writing about it years ago were afraid of the Kennedys. And I had my own personal experience. This book was about to sell to HarperCollins, circa 2006.
Yeah.
Right, before UFO Hunters. And one of the reasons that, it was very funny, one of the reasons that Harper was so interested in Rick and me as writers was that we had just gotten, we were getting these solicitations from the History Channel to do a pilot for the show, was then called UFO Road Trip, not UFO Hunters.
Yeah.
And so Pat Uskert and I were, you know, getting these, let's talk about this, the production, because I'd been on UFO Files since 2004. So for 2 years, I was doing UFO Files episodes for History Channel, right? And so then when we brought Pat Uskert into the mix to do this show called UFO Road Trip was actually Nancy's idea to do the show. She could, because of what Pat was doing with split screens and all kinds of stuff for seeing, well, gee, could a balloon be a UFO and stuff like that. She said to, you know, she said to Pat, why don't you take a little road trip and talk to people who've had UFO experiences and look at their film and just make some decisions about their film. Well, at about that same time, I had just made a movie over at Lifetime Television called When Husbands Cheat. And it was based on a book written by a Chicago private detective about how she caught her husband, who was a vice detective, cheating on her.
Right. Sounds like the quintessential Lifetime movie. That's why I love it.
Yeah, exactly. And so we were then talking about another movie called Green Ice, about this major DEA sting in the 1990s that brought down the Medellin cartel, in Colombia.
Right.
Right. That was why the drug cartels in Colombia turned over the distribution of marijuana to the Mexicans, because we'd shut them down by stealing, sucking up all their money. It was a money laundering scheme. It was a money laundering operation. So they were really interested in this, right? So finally, this and the company that was looking at this thing seriously, UFO Road Trip, was Hearst Television, which was becoming Actuality Television. So Hearst was looking at this thing, and then finally, the head of that division told this producer, "No UFO stories. We don't want them." So we have all this footage. So I'm now on History Channel doing the old UFO files, you know, black box UFOs, the Dragon's Triangle, things like that. So we take this to that company that's working for the History Channel. They fall on their face. They love it. Goes to History. History loves it. So right before they order a pilot, a few months before, this book, Dr. Feelgood, goes to Harper. Harper is thrilled. They want it. I mean, they are putting bags of money on the table. Then the head of that division at Harper says, "We're not going to do this." And Harper, and the editor is a fear. She says, "You're not going to do this because we'll lose the Kennedy family. We will lose them and all the Kennedy books." And that starts this cascade. That alerted the Kennedy family to what was in the book. And we'd already seen Kennedy's medical records. We didn't need any more.
Right.
Right? Alerts them. So now we have the Kennedys are an issue. And sure enough, when the book comes out, one of the big writers at Vanity Fair and Huffington Post, who's doing his own book on Jacobs, and that's the funny part about it, he was already researching the story on his own, learns about our book. We come together with information for a Huffington Post and Vanity Fair story. Vanity Fair, you'd think Vanity Fair, my God, this is their meat and potatoes. Nope. Kennedy's. We don't touch it.
Oh, my goodness.
Huffington,
this is the year.
Huffington,
this is the 50th anniversary. This would be the best
right.
time to come out.
Huffington Post. Howard Fineman, the big dude, Huffington Post. Oh, we've got the truth. Nope. Kennedy's. We stay away. That's the Huffington Post. Thank you, Arianna Huffington. You've done it again. Where do we get traction for this book? Fox. Because Fox loved the fact that all the liberal media ran because they didn't want to offend Carolyn Kennedy.
Yeah. Strange. It's a weird look inside what's the mainstream media right now.
Yeah, you open like this horrible box and you're staring into Medusa's head.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.